Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning, everyone. Hope you're having a very nice, brisk, sunny Tuesday here on the Lower Mainland. You're listening to Speak Up only on CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. And this broadcast is, as well as all of our broadcasts here at CJSF, are on the unceded and ancestral lands of the Hulkumilam and Squamish-speaking peoples who have been here since time immemorial. Now, to start off this hour of talk radio, I'm going to be doing something that, you know, is pretty common for Speak Up, and starting off with a bit of music. So I'm going to be playing some local Vancouver music from one of my favorite bands to come out recently. This is Bloom Effect with Surreal. Hope you enjoy. Once again, you're tuned in to Speak Up only on CJSF 90.1 FM. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Reporting from Vancouver, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. On February 17th, a National Day of Action was declared by various pro-Palestine groups across Canada, calling on members of Parliament to pick a side on Bill C-233, also known as the No More Loopholes Act. According to the press release for the Day of Action, Bill C-233 aims to close a current U.S. arms loophole that exempts at least 60% of Canada's military exports from public or parliamentary scrutiny. Currently, Canadian components are routinely integrated into U.S. weapon systems and transferred onward to organizations such as U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, and the militaries of nations such as Israel. A Palestine advocacy group in support of the bill gathered outside of Vancouver Granville MP Talib Noor Mohammed's office in order to express their support for the bill, and, according to those in attendance, protest Noor Mohammed's middling support and opinions on issues regarding Palestine.
So Talib has to choose a side. Will he vote yes on the No More Loopholes Act, or will he choose the side of Trump's illegal wars, ISIS campaign of terror, and Israel's genocide?
Yes, time to vote no. Yes, vote no for genocide. Yes for the act.
Yes, vote yes for the No More Loopholes Act. Vote yes. Let's say it together.
Vote yes.
Vote yes.
Vote yes.
We spoke with a local organizer for the event, Atia Jafar, about the background of this protest, as well as what they hoped to achieve.
So we're here today because Canada's complicit in genocide, and as concerned community members, we want to ensure that that is not the case moving forward. You know, Canadian weapons are being used by Israel in its airstrikes in Gaza, in the U.S. illegal assault in Venezuela, and in deadly ICE raids in American cities. This is happening because there's a U.S. loophole that means at least 60% of Canadian arms exported overseas go through the U.S. and are exempted from regulation and oversight that allows us to ensure they're not being used in international crimes and in war crimes. We know, in fact, that they are being used in illegal activities, whether it's Israel's genocide or Trump's illegal assault or illegal ICE raids. So we're forcing Talib Noor Mohammed to pick a side. It doesn't have to be this way. There's a No More Loopholes Act, Bill C-233. It's a private member's bill proposed by NDP MP Jenny Kwan, and the bill proposes to update Canada's current export and impact permits to properly reflect critical missing elements of the Arms Trade Treaty, an international treaty regulating the trade of weapons that Canada has signed on to. Canada has signed on to this treaty, and the updates would represent a significant step towards properly regulating Canada's military exports. It would ensure that we close U.S. loopholes so we're not allowing unregulated flow of arms overseas. We're treating parts like weapons, so we're not just thinking, oh, this is just a part, a product. No, if it's a part that's being used in a weapon to kill people, it should be treated as a weapon. It should be considered a weapon in legal terms. So that's what we're saying, that it should happen. We're saying that we want to ban complicity in war crimes, so we need to ensure that we adopt international law and prohibit exports linked to genocide and crimes against humanity. We want to end blanket permits. Every company requires an individual approval and human rights review. And we want to ensure that there's transparency and annual reports to Parliament on what Canada exports and where it goes.
He is in Ottawa currently. We found that out today. But have you been able to speak with him on this generally in the past? Like, has he provided a stance regarding this issue?
We know that, you know, many of us have contacted him since the beginning of the genocide on various issues in the ways that Canada, on the ways that Canada is complicit, and he has not responded. He often does not respond to our emails. He doesn't really book meetings with constituents. You know, if he does, he handpicks who he meets with. I've been calling him, I've been writing to him, and I have not heard back since the start of the genocide. So it's very disappointing. I would expect better, especially when we know that literally Canadian products are being used to kill children, to kill families, to commit war crimes. I would expect him to respond in a more urgent way, but he hasn't. We know that he was involved with supporting the NDP motion on Palestine that passed a while ago, now a couple of years ago, but he really was playing a big role in watering it down as well. And last time I spoke to someone from his office about this previously before today, they were trying to make a case that, you know, Tlaib is actually trying to water down the legislation and work with Jenny Kwan to water down the legislation, which is insane. You know, like, it's the No More Loopholes Act. It's very clear. It wants to end all the ways in which Canada's complicit in genocide, and it's really important to uphold it and not to water it down, to uphold what the legislation says currently, what the bill currently says. So I know that the Liberal caucus is divided on it. A lot of Liberal MPs are saying that they will vote for it, and we know that Tlaib is on, you know, thin ice in this riding. He came to a narrow victory in 2021, and, you know, the last election, we know that there was a red wave because of all of this fear around Trump. But we don't know what will happen in the next election, and right now a lot of residents in this riding are deeply concerned about the positions that he's taken and his moral compass in this moment of crisis.
What are the next steps after today?
So after today, many of us are going to continue to follow up. We're going to write the letter that the office has requested on this issue that will be passed to the Prime Minister's office, and we'll continue to call and express our concerns. And we're hoping that the Tlaib will actually, you know, hold a meeting with us. We've let them know that, you know, they have our contact information. They can let us know when he's available so that we can come in for a meeting. And we would love to come in and have a direct conversation. And we hope that before March, he will commit to voting yes.
This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca. And we are back with Speak Up Only on CJSF 90.1 FM. Thank you all for tuning in to that piece about a little protest that happened outside of Vancouver Granville MP Tlaib Noor Mohammed's office last week regarding his support or non-support on the upcoming No More Loopholes Act that should be discussed soon within Parliament. Thank you again for tuning in to Speak Up thus far. Coming up next, we have another piece. Another piece that I actually did, and this is an interview with Justine A. Chambers. And if that name sounds familiar, it may, well, one, you may just know her work and are familiar with her as an artist and educator and dancer, but she also was interviewed by our public affairs and talk coordinator Nicole very recently. Due to the fact that she was one of the headlining acts at this year's Push Festival for her dance project, The Brutal Joy, which was actually a trio project. And she recently also won an award, the Viva Award for 2025, which is pretty coveted and was something that was definitely shocking to her. And we decided to talk about it. And, you know, we ended up touching on quite a few things, not specifically related to said award, but it was a really cool conversation, and I'm really glad that we got to do that. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Justine A. Chambers. To start off the interview, I guess I should just say that I'm here with artist, choreographer, dancer, educator, Justine Chambers, and we're here to talk today about an award that you recently won, the 2025 Viva Award. And the first question that I had for you was just, what was that moment like, I guess, just finding out that you received it in the first place?
I was kind of in shock. Like, it's like my brain wouldn't hear it. You know, Melanie O'Brien called and she said, Justine, you know, I have good news. You're this person. And I went, what? And then she said it again and I went, what? And then my kid came running in from her room and said, Mom, did someone die? And I said, no, it's fine. I won an award. So I was just, I was really shocked. It's not something that was even on my radar as something that I would be, that is available to me. So I was really surprised and delighted, of course. I mean, I think for me, this award, what makes it extra special is that it's a jury of your peers. And that made me feel like a million bucks. Like, it just really, the people on the jury are so such extraordinary humans. And I thought, oh my goodness. And it also made me go, okay, like, no, game on, girl. Now, like, step it up. I think that's always my first response to these things is, like, live up to, you know, if you're just... I feel like when someone, when you're given attention, it's a call to meet that attention and consider what else you could be doing, which, and not in like a strange, not worthy way, because I do feel like I've worked very hard and it's just lovely to be recognized, of course, but I also think, uh-huh, now you keep going, you know? So motivating, shocking, delightful, and yeah, it's very cool. I can't even be cool about it.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. I like what you said about, you know, it's not that you're surprised in a way of like not feeling worthy of it, but more so that like now you feel like you have to sort of rise to that occasion of
absolutely
of the award. Yeah,
yeah, which I love. You know, it's always great to like keep going, like bring the A+ game, you know, or whatever it is, you know. That's I think that's, you know, what we have to do to stay interesting and interested. It's always more interesting to be interested than to be interesting, you know what I mean? But I think like it makes me want to grow a little bit, maybe harder than I was planning to or something. Yeah.
One thing I was really interested by was like the wording of the award. When I was looking into it, it said that like the Viva Award was established and is it's labeled as being a prize awarded to mid-career visual artists in BC. Is that a label that you would agree with or subscribe to? Like, do you see, especially in the context of a career that involves creative expression, do you see your careers having like a fixed start and end?
Oof, that is such, I mean, there's many debates about these things. And I think, you know, if we, you know, I am definitely mid-century at this moment of my life. So in that way, I'm like, you know, assuming that I'll live to 100, then yes, it's mid-career. But then also, yeah, I don't know. It's hard to think about being in the middle of anything, right? You know, like you said, there's this like kind of this sort of protracted continuum that we all feel like we're on. And it may be, you know, I think that that's a really tough question, because like, when are we mid-career, right? And you know, in some places it would be like, oh, if you're no longer emerging, you're mid-career. But yeah, I mean, I just hope that, yeah, I would love for this to be mid-career. I'll put it that way, because I think like, ooh, really, am I going to keep working all the way until I'm 100? But maybe I will. Like, who knows, right? But maybe in the realm of visual arts, I'm more mid-career than I am in dance. Maybe that's a better way of putting it, if I think about it that way. You know, like I started dancing professionally when I was 18. So I think that, but my sort of, my relationship with visual arts, I think, showed up like in the 2009, 2010. So maybe in that way it is. I mean, it's just even wild to say career at this point in my life. I don't think that I even, when I started to dance, when I decided that I was going to be a dancer, I don't think I could even see, you know, further than 2 years ahead, you know? But then now I can look back over 30 years and go, okay, maybe I did have a career, you know? Like, I did make it a career somehow. Like, how do we do these things? Because, you know, this never has always, it's, you know, there are so many talented artists everywhere, all over the world, right? And it's not, we don't always have like the right timing or the right opportunities or the right means to keep going. And I guess it makes me maybe in that sort of, now it makes me feel like I'm way past mid-career when I can look back and be like, wow, I had the support to do it. But yeah, mid-career. I also paused when I read that, I will say.
Yeah, because who gets to define that, right? That was something I was very curious about.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, it's funny because I think about like how granting bodies kind of define that. You know, it's like, are you emerging? Are you mid-career? Are you senior? Sorry about that noise. It's my SFU email. I don't know how to turn off that notification. Maybe that shows me as like a really mid-career. So I think that, yeah, maybe those things are defined by our support systems or the structures that allow us to keep going But for myself, sometimes I feel like I'm just figuring things out now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, just in preparing for this interview, I feel like I sort of gave myself like a crash course on just contemporary dance as a whole. Because, like, admittedly, it's not a medium that I'm extremely familiar with. But one thing I thought was really interesting is, like, in a few interviews you've done, you've kind of mentioned that you feel like in your process, you're sort of making the same dance over and over. And, like, how it's, you know, always about, like, the physical interrelations of every day and its different iterations and things like that. But I was curious because that can encompass a lot. And I wanted to know, like, how you decide which angle to pursue that from, whether it's, you know, like, doing a performance on the physical and social dynamics of, like, dinner parties, or more recently with the Brutal Joy, which is rooted in, like, Black dandyism and also your lived experiences as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, it does feel like the same dance. It feels like maybe I always have the same question. And I think that what, you know, the way I approach it is, like, usually has something to do with what's happening in my life or something that's recurrent, like a recurring thing around me, or maybe even an obstacle I feel like I keep coming up against. And I always think, wow, like, I am clearly ill-equipped to deal with this or to think through this or to crunch through this. And so how could I build a practice that would allow me to practice being a human? Like, I think that is really what my practice ends up being, is that I'm like, okay, how do I stay tethered when I don't like what's going on? Like, how do I not dissociate or jump ship? Or so, like, what are the ways I can stay with something that's difficult? You know, how do I stay in relation when the world feels impossible? Or how do I dodge this constant narrative damage that a narrative like this damage narrative that's attached to being racialized? How do I practice meeting that with something else? And so I think this is why I keep feel like I'm making the same dance in some way, because I think the questions are always the same, which is, like, always around being in relation to people, to places, to objects, to architecture, to the world, to power structures. But it's usually like there's, like, a little thing in me that goes like, ooh, I'm not able to process that as just in my own day-to-day humanness. So let me build a structure. Let me build a movement structure, a relational structure, a score, a choreographic imperative to practice that thing. And then maybe I'll have greater understanding about the world. And I think the Brutal Joy in particular, like, it's the most recent thing, came about because of the 2020 moment and because of what happened to Black artists in particular, which is, you know, getting a certain amount of attention and getting a certain amount, but then understanding that people really wanted to hang out in what was terrible about being Black. And I did not want to hang out in that because we live that every day. So I was like, what are the things we do? And it's not about, like, it is Black Girl Magic, but it's not just that. and it's not just about, like, Black excellence or rising above something, this idea that we need to rise above. I'm like, we've been rising, right? So for me, it was like, how do I work on embodying and articulating through gesture and through clothing already, or this other thing that's actually what's important to me, and this other thing that has allowed me to be in the world in this, like, really dynamic way, and this other way that has allowed me to survive terrible things or boring things, you know, boring conversations or and this kind of thing. So I think, like, that's like an example of, like, I was like, oh, there's something. And it's so funny because I'm just realizing this as I speak to you. That's interesting. I was like, oh, how did I get to that? But also about self-determination, you know, how do I decide what is enough for me or what is needed? And how do we not always acquiesce, and how do we assert ourselves and sort of empower ourselves to be the thing or to be in relationship to the things we want to be in relation, like, or how do I refuse something? And I think that I realized, oh, I've already been given those skills, right? And they show up in how we work through the electric slide, and fashion is a thing, right? Like, it's a thing. Mm-hmm. It's not trivial. It's not trite. It's not just adornment, right? It's agency, and it's audacious, and it's taking space and claiming space, and it's like taking a colonial structure and making it better, like we tend to do, you know. So so I like that. I think that's what I mean when I say like I'm making the same dance, because also family dinner for me was very much about how do you be in relation to people when your social codes don't match, right? And how can I like allow you to be yourself and still be myself? I mean, it's also connected to family, of course, but and then so we built these wildly outrageous, impossible scores to do while we eat with other people, while we still have to host, while we still have to do these things, which of course is stuff that we're doing every day, you know, like you forced to go to an event or a dinner and you've had a terrible day or you have 1,000 other things to do. And it's like, how do you be with yourself and the event and everything else? So I built these scores, which I think maybe are scores of attention, you know, that are around attention and noticing. Yeah, but it's, I'm at that place where like, oh, I made Brutal Joy and now we're touring it. And somebody asked me, like, I said, you know, I'm ready to make something else. And they said, well, what is it? And I'm like, oh, I haven't a clue, but but I'm ready to make something else. Like, I'm ready to be open to a new idea, you know?
Yeah. And like, and that process comes, from what I've heard, quite naturally to you, right? Like this, in a way, it does feel like the performances that you've done serve as like a processing tool, in a way as well.
Yeah. They're just about me trying to deal with being a human, I think, most of the time, right? And something shows up. I mean, I am working with like a very dear colleague of mine on something which really came out of him saying like, I got money, I got no money, but I got time. And I said, well, I'm really lucky because now I work at a university and I have a salary and I got time and I got a studio, you know? And this is someone I've danced with for 15 years and is a very, very close friend. His name's Josh Martin. He runs Company 605. And, you know, and he's like, well, should we just start hanging out in a studio, you know? And of course it was hilarious and glorious and irreverent. And I don't know what we're making yet, but we decided like, oh yeah, let's make something. So as it shows up, you know, and I do love to collaborate with people. I don't usually have like it's not true. I do choreographic collaborators. I think I'm not very good at, I don't go into a dark room to figure out something alone. Like nothing cracks from my brain, like Athena, you know, sprouting from Zeus's head. I am not that person. It's only with other people that I can think through things. So whenever someone says, hey, do you want to like work on something together? I'm always like, yeah. Let's do that, because you're going to make my mind do things it wouldn't do if I was just here with a pen by myself being like, come up with an idea, Justine. It just doesn't happen. Like I'm a very, like, I think I require other humans to understand things, you know? I'm not one to, you know, there's this talk of Martha Graham going into a room for however long by herself and developing her whole technique. And I can't even imagine how that would happen with me. I'd probably just watch Netflix and have a nap.
Yeah. I mean, prime alone activities, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. The way you speak about that, one thing I wanted to ask, cause you know, CJSF based at SFU, are there like instances or things that you can sort of pinpoint as ways your practice maybe has been influenced by the students that you've worked with since joining the School of Contemporary Arts here at SFU?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I think, you know, I think teaching is a feedback loop, you know, and I'm just as interested as learning as my students are, you know. I'm not really the teacher who wants to be at the top of the front of the room saying like, I know it all, let me share my wisdom with you. But I feel like everything I do is a proposition. And so what I learn, I think the most from them is that what makes sense to me does not make sense to everybody else. And of course we know this, like we know this, we're adults, we know this. And then you go to do something and then an 18-year-old is like, I don't know what you're on about. Like this makes zero sense to me, you know? And so I think what I learn, like this work of processing thought and processing communication around thought, and then also understanding that we all arrive with, my students arrive in the room with a whole bunch of stuff that I know nothing about. Right. And this understanding that they should be able to meet me where I am is ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. Although I would love it, but you know, it'd make my life be real fast, right? But this is so. I think in the what I learn or how they what they impress upon me is that I have to receive people knowing that I'm. What am I trying to say? Like, I can't take for granted that what I say is something digestible, right? Or that it is understood. And so it's put me in this process of having to really, like, break down my practice or how I'd like them to practice with me to sort of these nanobites of information, like bit by bit by bit by bit. Because not only am I facing the training that they received before here, I'm facing the way they grew up or the homes they grew up in or the culture that they're in, that they grew up in. And so, you know, people say, you know, dance is universal. Absolutely, it is universal, but it is not practiced in one way. And just because I danced one way or I've trained in one way, that does not cover all bases, right? And I think there is a little bit of a myopia that happens inside of Western dance forms, which is like, oh, if you can do ballet, you can do anything. This is not true. Right? If you can do contemporary dance, you can do any. Like, no, absolutely not, because they have values and they have hierarchies embedded in them. And then if somebody comes from a culture that those values and those hierarchies aren't there, then there's no way that they can engage with the work you're doing. So I think that teaching is, you know, several bites of humble pie. And then it is also like, can you truly articulate, you know, like they say this when you're writing, like, if you can explain it simply, it means you really know what it is. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing that I'm learning from them. I'm also learning from them that they actually are in the world in a really, really different way than, like, we're in the same world, but we are in a really different way. So I'm forced constantly. A good friend of mine, Kate Franklin, talks about teaching from the middle, not from the top of the room. And I think this teaching from the middle means that you have to learn how they're in the world. I see this with my kid too. You know, she's 10 and she's living in a different world than I grew up in, for sure, right? So I think that they allow me to process how the work is communicated and how the work is felt, in fact, which I think is our biggest form of communication, right? And so I learn that from them every single day. And some days we find ourselves and we've made a shared language and we totally get what each other's talking about and it's glorious. And then sometimes the next day that falls apart again. So I think they also teach me that inconsistency is just a staple of life.
Yeah.
You know?
I really like how you answered that, because I think that is something that is kind of commonplace within, like, the academic Western art world. Like a struggle, or maybe like a blind spot when it comes to effectively communicating art. You know, I think there are a lot of art spaces, whether it's in Vancouver or any other area of North America, where, you know, someone, an average person, can go in and see, like, the writing that describes an exhibit or something and be like, this makes no sense to me. And there's no one there to be like, to, you know, try to meet people halfway. It's kind of like, oh, you don't get it? All right, it's not for you.
Yeah, and this is a tragedy, right? Because there was this wonderful, I'm a part of a committee at FCAT that's run by Chantal Gibson, who's a artist and poet and communications prof. And we run this thing every year called Community in Practice, and this year it was about AI. And the woman who runs the Writing Center said to us how actually language is, like, writing is an equity issue. And, like, it had never occurred to me, which is embarrassing to say, and maybe I shouldn't be saying it so publicly, but this idea that there's a certain kind of writing that communicates in a certain kind of way, and the idea is if you don't get it, you're not allowed in the club, mm-hmm. right? And if you can't get down with academic writing, then there's something wrong with you. But we're not asking, is there something wrong with the writing? Right. And I think that's the question that you're bringing up, is like, is there something wrong? Because if you didn't read the didactic and you just went in the room and you saw the thing and you had a million feelings and it stayed with you, well, then the art did its thing. But if you read the thing and then you go, I'm not one to read programs or didactics until after I've seen the thing.
Oh, okay.
Sometimes it ruins it for me because I like the narrative I had in my head about what I was experiencing, you know, and then I read this other thing and I'm like, well, that wasn't happening, right? So, but I wonder about what kind of language we're using, or what kind of language actually we feel we need to use to sound like we deserve our position in that gallery, on that stage. And you know, I did my MFA, I graduated in 2024, doing my MFA at SFU, at the SCA, and I struggled with the form of academic writing, because for me, it was a little difficult in the way that it didn't express the values of my work. And I thought, ooh, all of a sudden I have to use this kind of wording, but it doesn't have anything to do with what I'm talking about. So I used footnotes as best I could to like put in the language that I felt needed to be there, because I love a footnote. But I thought about that too. I thought, oh, why are we not letting the thing be expressed in the form through words, through language, not the movement part, to reflect what the work is doing and how the work changes a room. And I'm sure there are many brilliant academics who do that. I'm curious about who we leave out when we insist upon, you know, the King's English in a particular form, in a particular order of events. You lay out a thesis and then, like, I always think about, well, what could we use time differently in someone's reading experience? So, yeah. And like, I need translators for art too. You know, I do. I don't get everything I look at, and I don't always understand what I'm looking at and or what I'm watching. And sometimes those translations do, having a translator of sorts really does help me see, feel, love, enjoy, dislike the work more on either side, right? And then sometimes I'm just left with the feeling of what I saw, which is kind of how I am. Like, I'm just like all feeling all the time, you know? But I love that you brought that up, because I think if students are listening, like, we do need to question those forms, how, you know, and even thinking how AI writes in that form also, and why could it not write in other forms or in other ways of organizing language?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's very embedded, right? So if you have an AI program that's taught on thousands upon millions of words of academic art writing, that's what it's going to regurgitate, essentially.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I even think about, like, sometimes my dad corrects my grammar in my texts.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah. Every now and then. My dad is a very good writer and loves language and loves books. But every now and then, and I'm like, well, you know, it's usually you and I, you and me, or me and, you know, this or my child, you know, it's how I use and I or and me. He likes to correct that. And I think, no, the other one was what I meant.
Yeah. You know, the English is very malleable. It's not.
Yeah. I mean, I think about even, yeah, my kid not long ago said to me, I was like, hey, we got to go, like, get your bag, get your coat, get your shoes, get your da-da-da-da-da. And she said to me, Mom, I'm putting the fries in the bag. And I was like, what did you just say? I don't even understand that. And then I was like, then I stopped and I was like, oh, that is such a good expression. Like, I'm almost there. I'm putting the fries in the bag. Like, it's and I just thought, oh, I love the English language, right? Like, when we can be that sort of playful with it, I was like, okay. Mm-hmm. Having a, I don't even know, Gen Alpha. I don't know what my child is, but there's, yeah, these organized. And of course, language, as we know, is meant to change.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Like, that's how it functions. Words mean one thing at one point in history, and they mean a completely other thing in another point in history, and we've forgotten what they meant before. So this idea that it should be in the state of constant change like everything else, why not, right?
Yeah. Okay, I think I had one last question for this interview, and that was, do you have any, like, you kind of alluded to projects coming on the way, but do you have any specific future plans with the resources that this award has afforded you?
Yeah, I think
you're able to mention, at least.
Yeah, I mean, one of my projects is going to the Fierce Festival. Well, the Brutal Joy is going to the Fierce Festival in the UK, which for me was a real bucket list festival that I wanted to be. I wanted to go to for like 10 years. And it invited, we were invited. And this money, should I not get my travel grant, this money will allow us to go even if I don't get a travel grant. And I think that's like, I would have probably happily gone into debt to go and do it there. Also, I found out one of my like dearest friends, Dana Michelle, who's like a really incredible dance artist based in Montreal. She's like, I'm going to Fierce this year. And I was like, I'm going too. So, so I feel like, yeah, just knowing I have this cushion that if for some reason, you know, you don't get grant, you're not guaranteed a grant. And this is kind of something I love about grants. You're not guaranteed anything, right? And you're not owed anything. But this means I will still be able to go. So it's a very far trip to the UK when you live in Vancouver. And those are not cheap flights. So I think that's the one for me, to be able to go do that particular work there, and know that it can happen even if the grant doesn't come through. It feels, wow. Yeah, it makes me feel incredibly lucky. And I feel like that's a great use of that money. And probably, you know, if the grant comes through, then I'll probably just use it to fund the next thing until I get it together to write a grant. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Once again, you are tuned in to Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. That was our interview with Justine Chambers on the 2025 EVA Award that she was recently awarded. And the ceremony for that, I believe, will be at the Vancouver Art Gallery on March 11th. Really awesome conversation and just a really cool person in general. So I was really, really glad to be able to speak with her about that. Coming up before our next talk portion of the hour, we're going to take a bit of a music break. This is from Vancouver band Whack with their track Connected off of their latest album, No One's Watching.
bird note. Throughout most of the Americas, great horned owls are the preeminent predatory bird of the night, and they are ferocious. Their prowess as hunters depends on acute senses and stealth, but their feet and long curved talons secure the attack. The outermost of their four toes has evolved to rotate forward or backward for handling squirming prey, an advantage that most other birds of prey lack. These feet let the owls capture mammals as large as hares and raccoons. The grip strength in those feet, 200 to 500 pounds per square inch, is equal to that of a much larger bald eagle and up to 6 times stronger than the handshake of a bodybuilder. Talk about a death grip. And these owls definitely don't skip leg day. With strong, thick legs, great horned owls are power lifters. A 4-pound owl can take flight with up to 6 pounds of prey. Their preferred hunting tactic is to perch in a tree on the edge of an open field, listen closely, then drop, flap, and glide silently toward an unwary animal. And from there, those amazing feet take over. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Who doesn't love music? Join the weekly discussion at the CJSF Record Club with other music aficionados checking out new releases and forgotten classics, exploring and learning about genres and loving music. Every Thursday at CJSF Burnaby from 4 p.m. till 5 p.m. Listen, learn, and share.
This is CICK News. Housing Minister Christine Boyle says Smithers is among 7 new BC communities selected for Phase 2 of the Heart and Hearth program, aimed at bringing people indoors and connecting them with supports. The Heart component focuses on outreach and relationship building with people who are unhoused, while the Hearth component provides temporary indoor accommodation paired with connections to healthcare, mental health, and addiction services, and longer-term housing supports.
How does the province assess readiness for something like the Heart and Hearth partnership in these smaller and rural communities such as Smithers compared to larger cities?
So it really begins with local government reaching out to request either being part of this program or requesting additional resources from the province to help support folks who are vulnerable in the community. And then the province looks to, you know, a number of metrics, including the point in time homeless count and the existence of encampments and the length they've been in place, as well as the willingness of a local government to partner to find solutions together.
And what conversations did the ministry have with regional partners such as Northern Health or Selkant Friendship Center or nonprofits before moving ahead or as part of the sort of holistic picture of deciding to partner with the town of Smithers?
I've been grateful to be able to speak with the mayor a number of times about her and the community's desire to address the encampment that had been in the community to find spaces to safely bring people inside. And that's really what this program is designed for, to be that first step where people can come in and have a safe and dignified place to rest their head, and then to connect with health supports, maybe mental health supports or addiction and recovery supports or other social supports as they are needed to move them along a housing continuum and a recovery journey when they're ready.
Okay, I understand that we're in the announcement phase, but are you aware of what the town of Smithers plans to do in and naming some of those supports that you just mentioned?
That's the part of the conversation we're at now. The Hearth part is the temporary housing part. The HEART part of the program includes a staff person who would be in the community working to do outreach and understand what the needs are of folks who are unhoused or living in encampments in the community, so that the service can be shaped around supporting them best.
Yeah. And I guess what timeline does the ministry anticipate for more permanent or year-round housing? You mentioned the emergency shelter in Smithers, which is currently operating until March 31st of this year.
So we are continuing to work on the Alfred Ave permanent shelter. I don't have a timeline on the completion of that, but that work continues alongside the temporary housing that will be part of the Heart and Hearth program.
Maybe this is too localized of a question, but the most recent local homelessness count, it showed a significant increase in people experiencing homelessness in Smithers, with 84% identifying as Indigenous. So how is Heart and Hearth designed to respond to our local demographics and trends?
That's a great question, and that's why we work closely with the local government and local service providers, and why it matters so much that the temporary housing that's part of this program is paired with outreach staff on site, so that the supports can be built around what the need is in the community, which may include cultural supports, may include connections to health or social services. All of that is really designed to meet people where they're at, bring them inside to a safe and stable place, and then help build those next steps alongside them. And local staff on the ground and the local community will really know best what that looks like. And the province is there to support that, to invest in the beds and people that are needed to help move folks along.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Yeah, anytime. Thanks for having me.
While the province frames Heart and Hearth as a partnership model, the town of Smithers says the work on the ground is just beginning. In this follow-up conversation, Smithers Communication Director Samantha LeBlanc explains how the municipality formally joined the program earlier this year after years of advocating for additional supports, citing high per capita homelessness numbers and ongoing encampment pressures. The town outlines plans for a public engagement process this summer, and Samantha describes how a local working group will be formed in collaboration with BC Housing, and how the temporary Heart and Hearth response fits alongside the longer-term Alfred Avenue housing project.
So council and staff have been advocating for years for additional support within our community. We formally joined the Heart and Hearth program just earlier this year, around the end of January. We were approached by the province, so that's started in February. And then a lot of the support is based on our community needs. Our latest point in time homeless count, which also is people experiencing housing insecurity, per capita is quite high. I believe it was about 77 people who were experiencing housing insecurity within our community, which is very high for a population of our size.
Do you know how the working group is going to be formulated, or how you're going to do outreach so that the right voices and organizations and perspectives are represented?
So BC Housing has a large part in implementing that. As the municipality, we will help identify any groups within our community. So that includes Indigenous organizations, outreach support, any of the social services we have in town, as well as municipal employees, mm-hmm. For things like, you know, site servicing, engineering, anything like that that they might need.
As a town works with the province to identify a site and also to determine bed numbers, what criteria would be informing site selection, and then also what kind of units this would be?
Yeah, so it really depends on our community need, and BC Housing is very open to exploring that. We don't have any answers on what it's going to look like yet. We are hoping the public engagement part of this will help us identify if there's, you know, some existing buildings in town that might be a good fit, mm-hmm. for kind of a longer-term shelter. I do want to also mention, though, that the Alfred Avenue project is more of the long-term solution. So just to be very clear on this, it is a temporary support to support our encampment efforts before the Alfred Avenue project is opened, which is expected for 2027 or 2028, which will be more of the longer term.
Mm-hmm. And do you have an idea of the timeline of where we are now, what we should expect maybe even by this summer?
Yeah, so we are working with BC Housing. We're in discussions right now about what that will look like, but we are hoping there will be some kind of public engagement and consultation either summer or late summer. So it will be this year.
We also saw the homelessness count, and it was 84% identified as Indigenous. So I guess, is there an approach that you're using to make sure that service providers are culturally appropriate supports for this temporary build?
So we will be working with a lot of our own local community providers who are already doing this work, and we're just hoping that it'll be able to provide a bit more care. It'll definitely be local supports, people who know what goes on in our community, people who work with these people already, and making sure that they're culturally sensitive to the experiences that these people may have lived.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
CSK News is funded by the Government of Canada, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and is a participating station in the Local Journalism Initiative. On behalf of my colleague Dan Messick and myself, Pam Hassan, thanks for listening.
For one last time, we are back with Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. Thank you so much to CICK News in Smithers, BC, and Pam Hassan for that piece that you just heard. Make sure that you stay tuned to CJSF throughout the day. We have a lot of amazing programming from Raccoon City to Typically Tuesdays to later in the night with Slumber Party and Bitcoover. But before all of that, in about a few minutes, we've got Democracy Now! Right at 11 a.m. with Amy Goodman. So stay tuned for that. Thank you all again so much for tuning in. We're going to end off this hour with some more local music, a favorite of this group, who hopefully you will see more of on the CJSF socials. Hint, hint, wink, wink. This is Sour Dope with Water Temple.